The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We're going to get started for the 145 program on aging and disability disparities. My name is Bob Dinnerstein. I'm a professor of law here at American University, Washington College of Law, and I direct our clinical program. I'm happy to be here moderating this panel. I'll introduce each of the panel members. They'll each speak for 10 to 15 minutes. And we'll have then plenty of time for questions from the audience, since I think everybody has indicated that what they really want to do is interact with you and not just be talking heads up here. So we'll try to be consistent with that if we can. Our first presenter will be Javi Glaser, who's an adjunct professor here at the Washington College of Law and also a member of the AARP's Health and Long-Term Care Team, where she focuses, among other things, on Medicare and pharmaceutical issues. She's a graduate of University of Michigan Law School. She's had a number of positions in health care work, litigation work, including head of the Prescription Access Litigation Project of Community Catalyst. She's been a lawyer at the National Women's Law Center and again currently is at the AARP, as well as here as an adjunct professor. Our second speaker will be Chris Herman, who's a Master's in Social Work and Senior Practice Associate for Aging at the National Association of Social Workers here in Washington. At the NASW, Chris develops resources for social workers in the field of aging and analyzes and develops policies related to aging. I love from her bio, I'll quote this because it's not something you usually see in a lawyer's bio. It says, although no longer in direct practice, Chris states that, quote, the psychosocial perspective continues to inform her work. Whether she's analyzing or developing policy, creating educational resources for social workers or older adults, or collaborating with colleagues. So it's nice to hear. We'll hear from Chris second. And then thirdly, we'll hear from Daniela Krame, who is our Associate Director of the Women in the Law Program here at WCL, also a practitioner and resident. Among other things, she has taught or is teaching courses like Gender Perspectives Across the World and Gender Equality and the State. And then the third of our three presenters. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Javi, and we'll take your questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be with you here today. I'm sorry, this is a little echoey. I'm going to talk sort of broadly about healthcare disparities in older Americans. One of the things that I find most interesting is the idea that as I was telling people that I was coming to give this talk, and they said, well, what are you talking about? Older Americans aren't subject to healthcare disparities. And my jaw just sort of dropped, because I was having these conversations with very experienced policymakers, staffers, lawyers who work on healthcare issues, and I was like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean that older Americans don't face healthcare disparities? And by and large, what they said is, well, older Americans have Medicare, they're taken care of. So a lot of what I want to talk to you about today is the fact that, unfortunately, although Medicare is a fabulous program, having Medicare does not indeed mean that you have been taken care of. It also doesn't take away, you know, the other disparities that you've heard spoken of earlier today, and as you will hear from other panelists today. I mean, as soon as you turn 65, you don't suddenly lose any issues with, you know, linguistic and cultural competency. You don't lose issues about whether there are physicians serving your community, so on and so forth. So those are sort of the big picture things that I want to look at. The other thing is, too often people think of older Americans just as that 65 plus age group. But really, older Americans, at least from AARP's angle, and I think this is sort of a wise way to look at it, look more at sort of 50 plus. So what about that group 50 to 64 who are not old enough to be a part of Medicare unless they have certain qualifying disabilities? How do they get their coverage? So I'd like to address these sort of three things in turn that really do, unfortunately, indicate that older Americans are in fact subject to a variety of healthcare disparities. The first is just to talk a little bit about Medicare. And here's the shocker. The good reason you are all already sitting down is that for people who have Medicare, their out-of-pocket costs are on average 6 times the out-of-pocket costs for someone with employer-sponsored coverage. Now, that's as a percentage of income, but regardless, this is a shocking, shocking number. Part of the problem is that unlike most employer-sponsored coverage and other coverage on the private market, there is no out-of-pocket cap in Medicare. So you don't reach a point if you've had a serious medical incident, you don't reach a point over the course of the year where, say, you've spent $20,000 of your own money and, you know, now the insurance kicks in and you're sort of fine. Medicare, there's no out-of-pocket cap at all. The other thing is that when you have Medicare and you go to the doctor or you go to pick up a prescription, you pay for that using what's called co-insurance rather than a co-payment. So many of us, I certainly know for myself, the last 5 or 6 insurance policies I've had, I'm fortunate enough to have coverage. I also have coverage that includes pharmaceuticals. Well, when I go, you know, there's a co-pay. Those co-pays are now tiered. It's sort of $5 for certain generics, maybe 10 or 15 for another generic, 25 for a brand name, and now a lot of policies are adding sort of a fourth tier, which is more expensive. But I know that, you know, month after month, that insurance, that, you know, it's going to cost me $5 or $10 for me to pick up that prescription. For people on Medicare, they pay 20% of the cost. So if the cost goes up over the course of the year, they pay for that. If it's, you know, a $100 prescription, they pay $20. If it's a $500 prescription, they pay $100. And that's not uncommon. I mean, the number of prescriptions, and I would encourage you to take a look when you're sort of signing off at your local CVS, what the actual, quote-unquote, actual cost is that you are then sort of just paying your copay for, but people on Medicare would pay, you know, a percentage of that amount. Same thing for when you go to the doctor. What is that actual fee? I pay $25 when I go to the doctor. But, you know, it could be much, much higher if, in fact, you are on Medicare. By and large, percentage of income has traditionally been a good way to look at health care costs. For example, at AARP, we suggest that no one should spend more than 10% of their annual income on health care costs. In Medicare, the average Medicare beneficiary spends a minimum of 30% of their income on health care expenses. And for the oldest and poorest of Medicare beneficiaries, they spend more than half of their annual income each year on health care. Medicare, although, you know, as I said, very important, very well thought of in a lot of different ways, does not cover costs such as eyeglasses, hearing aids, dental care, preventive services, not to mention most long-term care services. So if you need to be in a nursing facility for anything more than 100 days, Medicare is not going to be helping you with that. There is also an enormous coverage gap in the Medicare Part D prescription coverage benefit. So the good news is that Medicare now does cover prescription drugs other than those drugs that you get in your doctor's office. The bad news is that there is currently a $2,500 gap, a period during the year in which you get no assistance with your drug costs at all. And that $2,500 gap will be a $6,000 gap in another few short years. So if you imagine that 50% of all seniors in the U.S. make $20,000 a year or less, what a $6,000 gap in your prescription drug coverage could mean for you if you had significant pharmaceutical needs. So a lot of people who rely on Medicare and even Medicare with supplemental coverage are really stuck with these enormous costs that sometimes result in them not getting the care they need. The other thing, and I know this has been discussed earlier, although I was not able to be here, I know Mari Edelman was here talking about some of the racial disparities issues, is that there's an access issue just in terms of can you find a doctor that's sort of in your area that takes your policy. And although lots of doctors do take Medicare, there are simply not enough, particularly to support the aging baby boomer population. And considering that a lot of doctors are concerned with Medicare reimbursement rates for physicians. There's lots of disagreement about this, and I'm not going to get into that today, but absent congressional action, Medicare doctors are going to face a 21% decrease on March 1st. And one can imagine that that would only exacerbate this particular problem. The other thing, and the last thing I want to mention in terms of Medicare not necessarily being everything it should be for seniors, is that the financial assistance programs in Medicare are severely limited. In addition to being very limited and really only helping those sort of just above the poverty level, and for those of you who have studied any federal poverty issues, the poverty level is quite low and quite understated. But the program is designed to punish those who have even a small amount of assets. So if they have saved it all for retirement, if they own a piece of property and if they live in that, if they receive a small, even $1,000 insurance benefit when their spouse or partner dies, all of those things can make them ineligible for these financial assistance programs in Medicare. So that's Medicare. For the 50 to 64 group, that's a really interesting group because this is a group that if they have employer-sponsored insurance, they're fine. They're just as fine as anyone else might be. But there are lots and lots of people in this group, about 9 million in the country at last count, who don't have employer-sponsored coverage. If you don't have employer-sponsored coverage, you're really sort of up a creek without an oar, or whatever that expression is, because basically what ends up happening is that depending on where you live in the country, there are going to be one of two things. The first is that there are parts of the country where there is literally not a single policy available for sale or application if you are in the 50 to 64 age group. Insurers have just decided that this is not a particularly profitable market, and they stay out of it. So even if you want the insurance, it's not there to apply for. In areas where you can apply for the policy, people in this age bracket are faced with several problems. The first is that these policies tend to be prohibitively expensive, usually at least double the cost of an employer-sponsored program, often far more than that. There are states in the country where a person 50 to 64 would pay 15 to 20 times what a younger person would pay for an identical policy, regardless of their health status. So there's a real fundamental access to health care issue here. To sort of top that all off, very often these policies are not comprehensive. So again, it brings to bear this question of you can say you have insurance, but do you have insurance that's actually going to cover you when you need it? Very often it's not the case with people in these policies. Then, as if that were not enough to sort of add insult to injury for the 50 to 64 group, 17 to 28% of all applicants in the 50 to 64 group who find a policy that they can actually apply for are rejected when they apply for that policy. Now, most typically, this is for what's called a pre-existing condition. And, you know, that's been a subject of a lot of debate in the healthcare reform argument in the last year or so, or last 30 years, depending on how you look at it. And the end result, though, is that people in this age group who have, by the way, been losing jobs at a much higher rate than younger Americans in this recession are in a lot of trouble and rarely have access to good comprehensive care. Last but not least, and I just want to mention this briefly because I know you've heard a lot about this today and we'll also be hearing about it from other of the panelists on this afternoon's panel, is that other health disparities problems are in many ways simply compounded for senior citizens. So, you know, the problems, the health disparity issues they might face due to race, due to gender, due to disability issues, due to sexual orientation, all of those things do not go away. As I said, you know, you turn 50, you turn 65, these problems do not evaporate. So for seniors, particularly seniors in these, you know, sort of more set upon populations, they can really, really struggle in getting health care coverage. Thankfully, there are actually a lot of things that can be done to fix these problems. Very often, I will come to talk to a group about something for which no one has yet identified a solution. All of these are problems for which we have solutions, and it's a matter of implementing them by and large. Medicare, pretty straightforward, although hard to do in this economic and political climate. We need to put an out-of-pocket cap in place. We need to eliminate the asset test for financial assistance in Medicare. We need to raise the physician reimbursement rate, particularly for general practitioners and gerontologists, to ensure that they get into all the communities that need their services. And we need to close the coverage gap in the Part D for certain drugs program. In terms of the insurance market issues, these are fairly straightforward as well. Ideally, all insurers should be required to use community rating, which is sort of the true spreading of risk in a traditional sense of what it means to have insurance. All insurers should be required to offer policies that offer comprehensive benefits that will ensure that whoever is purchasing a policy actually is getting something for their money, and it will also allow consumers to sort of compare apples to apples in figuring out which policy they want to purchase on the market. And last but certainly not least is to eliminate the pre-existing condition barrier. This is one of those things that has a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, but for a variety of reasons we don't have time to discuss here, it's just very difficult to actually make it happen. In terms of general health disparities issues and what we can do, first and foremost, and I know this is terribly boring and yet still very important, we need to continue to collect data about health disparities. The reality is that we need to be able to fine-tune our solutions and make sure that we are getting the help where it needs to go and doing it wisely. Governments will typically not move without an awful lot of information, so we need to kind of move that along. We also need to put resources into enforcing existing civil rights rules and laws within the healthcare context. This is an area very lacking in funding and resources, and I really feel strongly could make a big difference in what's happening in general in terms of health disparities and issues with cost and access. Then I would say, as a matter of regular course, all medical providers should be provided with at least some level of cultural competence training, and translation services should be readily available at all healthcare facilities. This is one of those items where, you know, it seems like an unimaginable problem 20 years ago, but today we have the resources where at least telephonically, you know, people, no matter where they are in the country, should have access to a trained medical translator in, you know, any of their different languages. And then last but not least, I think that it's important to find some way to provide incentives to get providers into underserved areas and working with underserved communities. So that's sort of my big overview. The headline, of course, being unfortunately, even older Americans, or maybe in some ways particularly older Americans, do suffer from some level of healthcare disparities. And I look forward to talking with you more later. Back on this or not. Can you hear me okay? My name is Chris Herman, and as Bob said, I'm with the National Association of Social Workers and in my fourth year there. And just to give you a sense of where I come from, before I worked in NASW, I had over a decade of social work practice experience in aging and disability settings such as hospice care in the community here, and most of it in the Metro DC area with people in their homes, and also sometimes in assisted living and nursing facilities, because you can actually get hospice in those settings. And working with adults with multiple sclerosis, people who were in their 20s, 30s, 40s, like some of us in this room, whose lives were changed instantly with a diagnosis that for many people is progressive and can be debilitating, and also doing geriatric care management, that tended to be with a lot of what are sometimes called older adults, you know, over 75, over 85, many of them in their homes struggling to stay independent, oftentimes with very limited support, out-of-town family caregivers, etc. So that perspective, as Bob alluded to, really informs the work I've been doing on a more macro level and in developing resources for social workers and other professionals around aging disability issues. So I'm really pleased to be here and, you know, to have a chance to collaborate with you all from another discipline, because I think it's really essential that we work together as professionals, both on a practice level and on a policy level, to achieve some of the changes that Javi alluded to, many of which we would also certainly support. So in talking today, although I was asked to address challenges related to aging and long-term care, or as it's more commonly coming to be known, long-term services and supports, just a brief word of explanation, that's a term that's very common in the disability community and has been put forward there and gaining momentum for many years, I think, in aging advocacy organizations. We've come more recently to it, but can certainly appreciate the perspective that it's not always about care, but about getting the services and supports people need to maintain the greatest level of independence in whatever setting they're at. So just a terminology, you know, it's not to say long-term care is not an appropriate term to use, but you may start hearing both more and more. So even though I'm going to focus on challenges, I think it's really essential to preface my remarks by just stressing two perspectives that are inherent in social work practice and inform any analysis and development of policy we do as social workers, and I think you might find some of them congruent certainly with other things you've heard today, with what Javi said, in your own practice and thinking. One is a person and environment perspective. This is a key social work that we can only understand and help improve any older adult situation or any person's situation, really, by exploring and addressing the social context in which that person lives and operates. So as Javi alluded to, this perspective assumes that racism, ageism, sexism, homophobia, other biases underlie and perpetuate health disparities, both on individual and systemic levels. The second is the strengths perspective. This focuses on, in the aging and disability context, older adults, people with disabilities, their resources, their abilities, the contributions they make to society, and I mean that both economic and in other ways. And I think this perspective is very important because while it's great that there is so much more attention now being given to aging, as you know, in baby boomers, there can also tend to be a catastrophic tone that I think has its pitfalls. If we start to look at older adults as, I mean, it can lead to looking at older adults really as a burden to society, to the health and long-term care systems. And I think that, you know, while there are realities that are challenges that we have to deal with, it runs the danger of putting the problem on the group of people rather than on the system and the need for some of the reforms that Javi talked about. And this perspective also emphasizes that collaboration with older adults and people with disabilities is really critical if we're going to eliminate any of these disparities, because they know firsthand what the experiences are and often what the solutions need to be. And also, and I know you're going to hear more about this from Daniela, a collaboration with family caregivers. It's been very rare in my experience to work with older adults and to some degree with people with disabilities in which you're not also interacting with a family caregiver. And when I say family, I mean that in the broadest sense of the word, just whoever is significant to that person and provides support in various ways. Could be physical, economic, emotional.
So first, talking about older adults as a cohort, and how they talked about some of the differences between older adults and younger adults. Much of the data that I have is from the Administration on Aging, which tends to focus on 65 or sometimes 60 years and older. And so it's I appreciate the 50 to 64 perspective. I think it's complementary to some of the information that I'd like to share. And you can find much of this online. AOA is a great resource. Older adults are more than twice as likely to be diagnosed with two or more chronic conditions than their younger counterparts. And having two or more chronic conditions is associated both with lower income and with fair to poor self-reported mental health. Almost 30% take five or more prescription medications concurrently, and about half of that group also uses over-the-counter medications and dietary supplements. That's not always talked about, but both, you know, with by older adults and by healthcare practitioners, but it can certainly complicate the picture. So as a whole, older adults are more likely than other age groups to be living with serious healthcare conditions and taking a lot of medications to treat them. And they're doing this with, on average, obviously some exceptions and many factors feeding into this, but lower health literacy levels than younger adults. And in a system that, as you know, is becoming increasingly complex to navigate for all of us, regardless of age. This is a system that's also struggling, as Javi mentioned, to attract and retain qualified workforce to serve older adults. In 2008, the Institute of Medicine released a report, again available online, a great resource, and it's called Retooling for an Aging America, Building the Healthcare Workforce. This report highlighted two critical needs. One is the need for more healthcare professionals, such as physicians, nurses, and social workers, certainly not limited to those disciplines, who specialize in geriatrics or gerontology. The need for more Medicare providers is part of this that Javi mentioned, but also just having that specific training to say, you're a specialist, I'm a geriatrician, I'm a geriatric psychiatrist, I'm a gerontological social worker. I know even in social work, we only have about 9% of our workforce specializing in aging, and that is much less than we need. And also, the report highlighted the need for more training in geriatrics and gerontology across providers, regardless of setting. There are social workers, for example, and I imagine this may be true in law too, who are working in child welfare but wind up interacting with a grandparent who's raising a grandchild, say, in the home, and next thing you know, they're dealing with all kinds of issues they're not familiar with. That grandparent may have their own healthcare concerns, own social service needs. So it's really, you know, none of us can afford, even as we need specialists, none of us can afford to know nothing about aging anymore. The report also described the need for enhanced support of and training for both direct care workers and family caregivers. And again, Daniel will talk more about family caregivers. And it's encouraging to know that the Institute of Medicine is hoping to do a report on the mental health workforce with a strong aging component. Now, as with so much these days, funding for this report is tied up in healthcare legislation, so we are all working hard to see that it goes forward, but this is a report that would really focus in more on mental health needs, which is great, which are often left out of healthcare discussions. And ASW and many other mental health advocacy organizations, aging advocacy organizations, really support such a report. Lack of workforce isn't the only challenge that older adults face in gaining access to mental health services, though. There's also been a lack of parity in reimbursement for mental health services, and this has been the case in many commercial insurance plans as well, but specific to Medicare, the Part B benefit, Javi alluded to the 20%, 80%, when it comes to outpatient psychotherapy services, there's been a total discrepancy. It's been 50%, and that makes those services a lot less affordable. So fortunately, in 2008, Medicare legislation was passed that reduces beneficiary cost sharing from 50% to 20% over a five-year period. So it's kind of like there's a decrease in the coinsurance rate each year. And this will make mental health services much more affordable to older adults, but it's been a long time coming. And it's important to note, too, that Medicare mental health providers, such as clinical social workers, clinical psychologists, are affected by the cuts to physicians and other Part B providers that Javi alluded to, and so that just makes it harder, again, for older adults to find practitioners who can provide the mental health services and accept their insurance. So shifting to disparities among older adults, I'm going to talk briefly about women, LGBT individuals, families, and racial ethnic minorities. Obviously not a comprehensive group. There are other factors we can consider, such as geography, that influence health disparities. But for each group, economic insecurity and challenges accessing high-quality health and long-term care over lifespan exacerbate health disparities as old age is how they live in. This is especially important. Some studies have shown that assisted living, for example, while there are certainly affordability initiatives and Medicaid waivers can cover some assisted living services, research has shown that communities continue to be disproportionately located in areas with higher wealth, a higher educational attainment, higher housing wealth. And then, of course, private pay services to maintain independence at home, like a home health aid, oftentimes, have very little coverage from Medicare, and Medicaid can be hard to get and may need supplementation. So for women, we constitute almost 60% of the population aged 65 years and older, and women 85 years and older outnumber men by about 2-1. In general, women have less money to meet their health and long-term care needs. Median annual income for 2008, for example, was $25,000 for men and $15,000 for older women. And so it's no surprise that older women are nearly twice as likely as older men to live in poverty. Older women are also more likely to live alone than older men, and this increases the risk of poverty. So again, perhaps it's no surprise that older women constitute about 3/4 of nursing home residents 65 years and older. And poverty rates are especially high for Black and Hispanic Latina older women living alone. So economic security is related to a lifetime history of, on average, lower wages and benefits such as pensions, less time in the paid workforce, which decreases Social Security benefits and other retirement savings. And as you know, that's related to raising children, other family members, family caregiving. And health-wise, although women tend to live longer than men, they're more likely to report at least one functional limitation in old age. So whether we have a longer healthy life expectancy remains in question. LGBT aging. I think you'll find on this topic an excellent resource in the report Outing Age, 2010 edition from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and SAGE, which is Services and Advocacy for Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Elders. Lack of visibility ranges from lack of inclusion on healthcare forms and research and data collection, and an invisibility is reinforced by a lack of cultural competence among individual health and long-term care providers and within systems. It reinforces a sense of stigma that keeps many LGBT people in the closet throughout their lifetimes, but then especially in old age, it's not uncommon for people to have been out all their lives and then move into a residential care setting and go back into the closet for fear of the reactions they're going to get from their peers in the setting, from the providers. This invisibility and lack of respect extends to relationships. Some states don't honor hospital visitation. Powers of attorney for health care may not be honored. And there's a lack of recognition for caregiving relationships, partner, or other family of choice under the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act. Economic disparities are especially, thank you. Workplace discrimination throughout the lifespan is especially rampant for this group because there's a lack of federal employment discrimination protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, would change this. It's certainly something in the study has been advocating for in many other advocacy organizations. And just skipping quickly, there are some hopeful signs of progress. The Administration on Aging has approved funding to create a national LGBT Aging Resource Center, which is very exciting. And the Institute of Medicine is conducting a study on LGBT health issues and research, which is not specific to aging, but hopefully will yield some information that is relevant to LGBT older adults. And very quickly, to sum up on, with a couple notes on race and ethnicity. I'm sorry to cut this part short, but want to respect my colleagues' time. Poverty is very rampant among people of color who are older adults. Black and Hispanic Latino older adults as a group, now both women and men, are about 3 times as likely to live in poverty than older white adults. Health outcomes are lower, and access to services. Just one example, research has shown that African American older adults are more likely to live in lower quality nursing homes than whites, for example. What do those patterns tell us about access to care? Thank you. So in conclusion, we need action on policy and practice levels both to address health disparities between older adults and other age groups. Culture and linguistic competence is essential to reducing disparities among older adults, and we can't succeed in any of these efforts without engaging older adults and family caregivers in the process. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniela Kryam, and as Bob said, I am the Associate Director of the Women in the Law program here in the law school. I also teach a couple of classes here at the school, and I see students out in the room to whom I will apologize because they have probably been hearing about this project for almost as long as I've been working on it, because it's something that we talked about a lot in some of the classes that I've had. My talk today is going to be about long-term care or long-term support and services. Either term here is very useful. All of us know, are likely related to somebody, or perhaps even are someone who requires some form of long-term care or long-term support and services. A year ago, new federal regulations were promulgated to create a new delivery system option for people who do receive federally funded long-term care through the Medicaid program. This new type of delivery system is called consumer-directed care, or often it's colloquially known as cash and counseling or self-directed care. There's about a million names for this kind of program. It's not per se a new program. It is now, however, acceptable in all levels, in all Medicaid state programs. Before this kind of program, which I'll describe in more detail, was available only in little tiny pockets all over the country as experimental little programs, or programs that were funded by states or by localities. So what we're now looking at is an option for large-scale federal funding of a new kind of delivery system for long-term care. So my talk today is about those regulatory changes and what I feel some of the impacts of those regulatory changes might be. So let me back up for a second. Cash and counseling is what I'll call it for purposes of today's talk. Cash and counseling amounts to an individual account that a Medicaid beneficiary can use to purchase goods or services for their long-term care. This is in lieu of having Medicaid pay for a person to go into a long-term care facility like a nursing home or some other kind of institutional setting. So those of you who were here for the council member Katenya's speech earlier, he talked about home and community-based care. Well, this is one way to pay for that kind of home and community-based care. Up until now, in home and community-based care programs, aides were sent out from an agency, right? So you were part of the system, and the agency would send an aide to come to your house. So what's new here and what's different? This is actually instead an individual account that a Medicaid beneficiary can draw down on to choose and pay their own long-term care workers. So basically, they've cut out the middleman, right? They've cut out the agency here, and the money will be flowing more or less directly to the beneficiary, who then is going to pay their worker. They can also buy some goods or services. Today we're going to focus on the purchasing of a long-term care aid. The counseling part of cash and counseling, because the first part is the cash part, the counseling part comes in the part, presumably in the form of some sort of training or assistance in how to hire, fire, or train a long-term care worker on your own. Most of us are not used to being employers, so people would require some assistance in that. Some assistance in figuring out even what it is that you need to be able to either age in place or remain in your own home if you're a person with a disability. Setting up a monthly expenditure plan that you then need to stick to. And it appears that most of the places that have implemented this also end up serving as fiscal agents, which basically means they cut the checks and they do things like withholding and taxes and all of that sort of thing. Cash and counseling has several purposes. There were several reasons why states started to experiment with this and why the federal government is allowing its adoption on a larger scale. The first and most interesting and important, I think, is that it increases the autonomy of the beneficiaries who choose their services and hire, fire, and train their own aides. This fits in with a neoliberal conception of autonomy. By neoliberal, I mean a sort of a free market, consumerist-based approach to all kinds of things, like healthcare and Social Security, that were pretty popular under, or very prominent under, the Bush administration, the second Bush administration. He frequently called it things like the ownership society, right? And it was part of the whole move to, say, privatize Social Security. Well, this is along a similar kind of vein, right? Instead of having an agency, kind of the big government model, deliver care, people were going to choose and direct their own care. It also, however, is very resonant because it not only fits with that kind of more politically conservative view, it also fits in with the civil rights focus of the disability rights movement, which has struggled for many, many years to effectively foreground the capacity of persons with disabilities to control their own lives. And here we're talking about not just sort of a vague control over your own life, but very specific, extraordinarily intimate decisions, right? You are talking about being able to choose the person who dresses you, who feeds you, who assists you with the literally most intimate bodily functions that you can imagine if you are a person with physical limitations. This program also has an interesting side effect that I think is part and parcel of the program. One of the things that was that Chris alluded to was a severe shortage of what are called direct care workers. Those are the people in the long-term care workforce who go out into the community, either through home and community-based programs or through cash and counseling programs, and actually provide the long-term care to elderly adults, to non-elderly adults with disabilities, as well as kids with disabilities. There's a crucial shortage of these direct care workers already, and this is even long before they're needed by the baby boomer generation. One of the ways in which CAST and counseling addresses this long-term care labor shortage is by opening up a new pool of workers. And that pool is the friends and family members of persons with disabilities or people who are aging and require assistance. My larger project, which I don't have time to go into entirely today, is to critically analyze sort of this shift in policy. And what I'm looking at is while this program has some astounding strengths and some real benefits, I think it also carries with it some hidden costs that we need to be very cognizant of if, in fact, we are going to move on a large scale towards this model, which I predict we will. Briefly, my concerns can be categorized into three clumps. The first is this focus on autonomy. The autonomy discourse, particularly in the more neoliberal or politically conservative form, transforms the beneficiary, our Medicaid beneficiary, right, who are typically a lower income person with special needs, with a disability or a health issue, transforms these beneficiaries into quote unquote consumers. So the cash and counseling program very self-consciously does not call them beneficiaries, which is what they're typically called in Medicaid, right, but actually calls them consumers and makes these people into consumers of healthcare. And this is, you know, for those of you in the healthcare field, this is very in keeping with the sort of consumer model in healthcare. At a sort of a much larger kind of philosophical level, what I think this does is it starts to equate the ability to consume, right, by being a consumer, with a kind of a citizenship, a social citizenship, which is by way of saying that if you are still consuming, you are still part of society. Secondly, I think that this kind of a program, which emphasizes the autonomy of the individual and sort of devolves a large-scale government program down to the individual level, emphasizes individual solutions in which each person is responsible for his or her own long-term care decisions. And it, while that can be very beneficial in some cases, it hides some of the structural nature of some of the issues faced by the elderly or by people with disabilities, particularly those issues related to other forms of bias like race or gender. It also blinds us to the possibility for creating resilience amongst communities, right? Because one of the things that we know about people, and Chris mentioned this, which is that when you're dealing with, say, a person who wants to age in place, you're very rarely dealing with just that individual, right? You are dealing with their family. And as Chris noted, broadly construed, right? The community that cares for this person is also deeply involved. So an emphasis on this kind of individual thinking leads us away from pooled or collective solutions to problems, to the common problems faced by all families who have a person with significant health issues in them. What I'm going to focus a little bit more on today is my third set of concerns, which is the possible ramifications of the transformation of the employment relationship away from an agency model to a model in which the person is directly employed by the Medicaid beneficiary. And I'm really interested in the relationship between these long-term care workers and the consumer or the beneficiary of the services. The reason why I am so interested in this relationship is because, for the most part, the people who participate in cash and counseling do not choose workers at random. Who are they picking to be their long-term health care workers? In the pilot programs for cash and counseling, somewhere between 60 and 80% of the people enrolled in the programs picked a family member to provide their care. And they chose to use government funds to pay them. I have no conceptual problem with that, and I certainly believe that all caregivers should be compensated or remunerated in some way. But I wonder what this does, because this is a major transformation. So who is the long-term care workforce outside of cash and counseling? Let's look at what the status quo is. Long-term care workers, direct care workers, are part of the low-wage workforce. They're 90% female. They are disproportionately women of color. They work without the protection of federal minimum wage or maximum hour laws. They work without OSHA protection. They have very, very spotty workers' compensation coverage. And this is especially ironic given the very high rates of on-the-job injuries suffered by people who do the very physical labor of caring for other bodies. They earn, on average, somewhere between $8 and $10 an hour. They have very, very low rates of their own health insurance. Many live in families who are eligible for public assistance, which tells you a little bit about what their economic status is. So it's no wonder we have a labor shortage. But this field is oddly immune to the laws of supply and demand. For a variety of reasons that we won't go into today, wages don't increase in this field, notwithstanding the shortage of labor. There are a couple of reasons for this, and there are a couple of labor pools which can be tapped into, which mean that the wages in this field stay low. In the private market, this is largely immigrant labor, and to a degree that we're not exactly sure of, but we can be certain that it exists, undocumented immigrant labor, which of course can, which pulls downward pressure on wages. The other, of course, is the unpaid caregiving done by families, which amounts, you know, if you actually try to put a dollar figure on it, around $300 billion, which is, you know, as much as the rest of the long-term care field that is actually paid for. So what's new? Under the old system, a family member was very unlikely to become a paid caregiver because of the agency model, right? You weren't going to go and hire yourself out to an agency where you could be sent to any worker if what you want is just to be able to care for, say, your aging mother or mother-in-law. or even your own spouse. Also, under the old rules, immediate family members, legally liable family members, spouses and parents weren't even allowed to become paid caregivers under almost any circumstances. So with cash and counseling, all of a sudden, you can easily hire your own family member. And you can actually easily hire a parent, might hire themselves, actually, to care for a child with a disability who was enrolled in the program, or a spouse could be hired. My concerns, which I'm going to only touch on very, very briefly here, is that this program, which kind of is based on this consumer model, right? Like, I could go out with my voucher and buy services, but what it turns out I'm actually buying is the services of my family. So we have a kind of a discourse about autonomy, right? About self-determination and self-direction, but what we really see people doing is re-embedding and re-meshing themselves in the communities that have been caring for them all along. And so what I'm worried about is this change when you look at making someone into a consumer and a provider of services. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when what you're talking about is people's family members. And instead, what I would encourage us to think about is looking at people as units, as caregiving units, right? People are taking care of one another. That appears to be what people choose to do if given the option. And so rather than sort of pitting the interests of the beneficiary against those of the worker, we maybe need to consider them together. By splintering the employer, by saying that people will no longer work for an agency, right, which is sort of a big entity, but rather work for lots and lots and lots and lots of individual consumers, one of my concerns is that we reduce the ability of long-term care workers to engage in some collective bargaining, which has been effective in raising wages. So now all of a sudden you have a whole pool of workers, whether they're family members or not, who are very unlikely to sort of band together to attempt to raise the really dismal wages and improve the really dismal working conditions in these programs. Finally, I have one last concern that I'm not going to address today, and that is sort of a larger question about what happens when we commodify family labor. Feminists have actually been sort of making these demands since about the Civil War, sort of saying that we need to recognize the economic impact of women's caregiving labor. And so one thing that I will point out in closing is that this is the first time, really, that we're doing it on a large scale. So this is a program that bears watching because it's going to tell us quite a bit about how we think about paying family members to basically take care of their own. Thank you.
So we have about 10 minutes for questions. Unfortunately, one of our panelists did have to leave to go back to her day job, but we have two terrific panelists. And I'll just open it up. Yes.
Yes, I actually enjoyed all three panelists, even though the third isn't here to hear my comment. But Daniela,
I found it fascinating listening about the cash and counseling strategy. Is that conceived to be a strategy that would be total, or would there be an option of that versus, okay, and you probably know why I asked the question, is that I'm concerned where we have older adults who do not have a family complex that can even step to the plate in such a situation, and with the economy and poverty and other things happening in our society, I think that's a larger group than we would expect to be there. Also with smaller families.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great one, because I know just looking at my extended family structure, I have 100-year-old aunts, people are banded together.
Yeah.
They would do well with that. Then I look at other examples where people are just an individual and would have to go to the fiscal agent model, which means we're back in the system.
Yeah.
So people who could manipulate and do things with it. So
let me just answer that quickly. The way that it's designed is, Can everybody hear me? is that it is an option, and it is actually, if a state enacts this in their Medicaid program, they are required to retain also the other model. And it is very clear to me from the data from the demonstration studies that your point is exactly true, that if a person is not already embedded inside of a caregiving community, the odds of them being able to hire their own worker are close to zero. So one of the big problems is where to find a worker. But agencies have this problem too. And so this allows people to find workers that the agency could not find. So if you have access to those people, to family members, particularly people who are embedded in, say, church communities, may well have a good time finding a worker. But if you are not already embedded in a caregiving community, this is not a program that's going to work for you. They did recognize that, and the other model will continue to exist.
Other questions? Yes.
I missed some of the discussion about the cash and counseling. Now, I did do a one-time organized caregivers in the state of Maryland. And one thing was that this is just from public. And one thing was that working with them, everyone is so dispersed. So nobody knows each other. Like, it's easy to organize a group of people that work together, that know and have the same needs that they can discuss amongst each other. But dealing with the state of Maryland, they weren't very invested in it, so they'll just give you a list, and you'll just go and try to get these people to join a union, and they weren't interested because they don't really understand the need why. So what efforts are being done? And this must be like, because I know every state has a caregiving agency that has, you know, caregivers that sign up, because a lot of these, most of the people we work with actually weren't family members. They started because they had family members that needed caregivers, and then they realized, you know, I can make some side money for this, so let me find some other folks. But a lot of times what would happen is this would be their side job. So this would be something on the side that they did other than, doing it for somebody else and doing it for like four other people, or maybe working, you know, somewhere else and then coming home and then making sure you check on four different folks. And I just found that I think that has a lot to do with why there's such a, because of the way the workforce is, I feel like it doesn't do very good for us. And then I think that it has a lot to do with the work ethic and everything. So what has been done between states, actually getting states involved so that they can provide much more of a, just a different work environment for this whole industry.
I believe it calls for a yes or no
answer. Well, organizing care workers of any sort, this is true in child care as well, is very, very difficult because it's one of those funny fields, right, where you have a tendency to grow very, very attached to the people who you are directly working with. So organizing these workers is notoriously difficult. There have been some very successful efforts at organizing long-term care workers and child care workers also, most notably in California. And in that state, actually, almost all of the long-term care workers have an option of joining a union, and they took the strategy of organizing workers centers to do exactly what you talked about, to actually bring people together. So they literally created a place where people would come, you know, have little meetings and to get training and stuff like that, mostly so that they would get to know one another and form a kind of a collective community that could then look at the fact that they were all making $8 an hour and trying to live on that in Los Angeles County, which is a very expensive place. And agitating, in some cases very successfully, for increased wages and better working conditions, and actually not only for themselves, but actually have gone so far as to agitate for increased benefits for the people, for their beneficiaries, for the people that they work for. So in California this past fall, the state's obviously in a terrible fiscal crisis. There was the in-home supportive services workers union there is quite active. They fought the governor really hard on across-the-board cuts to long-term care services, not on behalf of themselves looking to keep their jobs, but also on behalf of their beneficiaries. So there are efforts, there are ways to do it, but I think cash and counseling actually literally undercuts that and cuts that off at the knees.
Okay.
I think that once you are working for an individual beneficiary, it's not like you can get more money out of the, you know, you can't get more money out of a rock. I mean, this person is given a set benefit, and it's not that going and asking them for more is going to make more money. You know, your beneficiary is a poor person by definition, because they're part of the Medicaid program, they're in the Medicaid program. So when there was an agency to go for that could then lobby the state for additional funds, collective action was possible. I think with individual beneficiaries, what we're going to see is already really bad wages and difficult working conditions basically frozen with very little potential for improving.
We may have time for one more.
I just have a quick question about your cash and counseling program when it comes to kind of like looking at the difficulties already with establishing care in rural areas where there's even less access to long-term care workers, and then also with the mental health field where there's even fewer agents in that area. Well, what kind of things do you think they need to, kind of like those issues clearly need to be addressed, and do you think there is possible to address those issues with the current, the way the current program is designed to work?
You know, the rural question is a really interesting one, in the sense that despite all of my reservations about cash and counseling, I do actually think that for rural communities, this actually works quite well for some people. So, for example, in New Mexico has implemented this program pretty widely, and New Mexico is I'm from New Mexico, and I happen to know it's like 99% wild, right? And there's like a few people that live in the city, and the rest of us all live out in the country. And it's particularly on the Native American reservations, there's huge distances. So, you know, a care worker couldn't serve three different clients because they all live, you know, they would live, you know, 80, 90 miles apart. And so for rural communities, the ability to bring a little cash into what's probably a very cash-poor economy, into a household and into a family by using cash and counseling, it might actually be quite beneficial. And so that's one community for whom this could really work, and then a more centralized, you know, sort of model doesn't work as well. Now on the mental health front, that's much more difficult because families, you know, families are places of safety and refuge for a lot of us, and for others, they can be places of that are much more difficult and that are not safe spaces. With mental health issues, I think those problems are magnified, particularly if you're going to combine mental health and substance abuse in families. And keeping people ensconced within their family may not be the best option for them. So I couldn't really answer that, but I think that we have to tread carefully.
I want to thank the panelists for a terrific discussion. Thank you for your good questions, and I guess we have a break now.
Thank you.